Today on the show, we have round two, Dr. Aaron Kamins. You might remember him from such episodes as the Virtual Australian Museum of Paleontology, or VAMP. Aaron is back to tell us about the original drop bear, Thylacoleo carnifex. Aaron explains the power of combining trace fossils with the body fossil record, why comparing Australian ecosystems to those from Africa is a bad idea, and most exciting of all, the hunting behaviour of this incredible apex predator. Pals in Paleo presents Thylacoleo with Aaron Kamins. Let's go back. This is Pals in Paleo, the podcast that connects you with some of the best and brightest paleontologists and their incredible work. I'm your host, paleontologist, PhD student, and fossil fanatic, Adele Pentland. You can keep up to date with the show and see cool photos of the fossils we talk about by following us on Instagram at Pals in Paleo, spelt the Aussie way, ending A-E-O. Pals in Paleo acknowledges the land throughout Australia and recognises First Nations people as the original scientists, engineers and technologists of this land. We acknowledge their connections to land, sky, all waterways and community. We pay our respects to the elders past, present and emerging and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples today, particularly the Bunurong and Woiwurrung peoples of the Kulin Nations on whose land we recorded this interview, and the Kaur people on whose land this episode was also recorded. Pals in Paleo recognises that sovereignty was never ceded. This was and always will be Aboriginal land. This is Pals in Paleo, the podcast that connects you with some of the best and brightest paleontologists and their incredible work. I'm your host, paleontologist, PhD student, and fossil fanatic, Adele Pentland. You can keep up to date with the show and see cool photos of the fossils we talk about by following us on Instagram at Pals in Paleo, spelt the Aussie way, ending A-E-O. I'm so excited to share this with you. This episode has been a long time coming, and it was actually requested by Breck Curtis via Instagram stories. Every now and then I'll ask what I should talk about or who I should have on the show. Thanks heaps for your amazing recommendation and of course your patience, Breck, because I wanted to get Aaron on the podcast pretty much straight after we finished recording our bonus episode on VAMP. But I also knew that Aaron was going to present this work at CAVAPS at this conference, so I decided to wait and record this one in person. Hopefully this episode lives up to the hype, but if you tuned into our chat about the virtual Australian Museum of Paleontology, or you've met Aaron in person, you'll know he's super knowledgeable and a well of information. Before we get into our interview, though, I'm gonna interject with a quick random fossil fact. It's less of a newsflash and more of a PSA about a fossil or something paleo-related I think you should know about. Today's random fossil fact is that the Natural History Museum in South Kensington is home to gargoyles inspired by pterosaurs, which again are winged reptiles from the age of dinosaurs. So, friend of the show, Sam Beeston from episode 13 on Diamantinosaurus is currently doing her PhD in the UK, and when she had just moved overseas, she sent me a photo of this particular gargoyle. So not only is there a pterosaur gargoyle, which is actually based on the first pterosaur described by Western scientists, Pterodactylus antiquus, which is from the Jurassic Age limestones of Bavaria in Germany, but accompanying that one, there's also another gargoyle based on Homotherium, which is a scimitar-toothed cat. In fact, the whole museum was designed with nature in mind. The architect in charge of designing the Natural History Museum was Alfred Waterhouse, but the superintendent of the Natural History Collections also had a hand in some of the sketches and plans for the building. Might have heard of him. His name's Richard Owen. So Sir Richard Owen wanted to both inspire the public and scientists alike, which is something I can totally relate to, and his vision was to celebrate the beauty and diversity of life on Earth. Not only are there these funky paleo-themed gargoyles made from terracotta on the outside of the building, but Owen supplied the architect, Alfred Waterhouse with specimens and scientific drawings. And then once he created those designs, he then got professors associated with the museum to like double check them for scientific accuracy or what they thought was accurate at the time. So there's some really cool concept drawings of ornate decorative doorway panels featuring dodos and columns covered in this weird pattern, taking inspiration from extinct species of trees. And I'm totally in love with this idea at the moment because I've heard this term thrown around before that design is about problem solving. And to be honest, I never completely bought into that philosophy until I was out mustering sheep randomly one day. And it just hit me that design can be problem solving because it can really do science communication. And I've fallen in love with the idea that I can combine my love of color and creating physical things with my knowledge and understanding of paleontology. So I'm currently working on another side project because obviously I don't have enough, but I'm not going to mention anything else about that. But if these are things that resonate with you, I'll include a link to a couple articles talking about the process of designing the Natural History Museum and how Alfred Waterhouse and Richard Owen created, quote, a cathedral to nature. Now, speaking of Sir Richard Owen, the NHM needed more space and they needed to create this new museum because the organization was acquiring fossils from overseas, which, as we'll talk about a little bit later, just very briefly, it's pretty problematic to say the least. But one of the fossils Owen got his hands on and described was, in fact, the star of today's episode, Thylacoleo. With that, let's now shift gears and get the lowdown on this incredible apex predator with the man of the hour, Dr. Aaron Kamens.
Shall I get into it?
Let's do it.
Today we have a returning guest, Dr. Aaron Kamens.
Thanks for having me, Adele.
So we're recording on the traditional lands of the Eastern Kulin Nation, so I'd like to acknowledge the Woiwurrung and Bunurong people and their elders past, present and emerging, and acknowledge their connections to the land, water and sky.
And I'd like to acknowledge the Kaurna people, the traditional lands that I live on, and of course all the other nations that we work on in paleontology here in Australia.
Yeah. We have a really exciting topic. This has been requested. We are going to talk about Thylacoleo carnifex. But before we get into that, Aaron, you're a lecturer at Flinders University.
Yes, I am.
Yep. So you teach, and I had the privilege of seeing a bunch of your students as well presenting. The Flinders group is one of the strongest for paleo now. It probably wasn't when I was going through undergrad, so it's going through a bit of a renaissance. What does it mean to you to be like working in this space and mentoring up and coming paleos?
Well, I feel extremely privileged to work with the group of people that I work with. We've got a fantastic group at Flinders, and we've got a fantastic group of paleontologists here in Australia, as we've just seen in the conference. But what we've got that's really special at Flinders is a kind of critical mass. So quite often we're a bit isolated in the labs that we work in because we've got a range of different paleontology academics working on different things. We can collaborate within our lab. We can also deliver quite a diversity of different things to our undergrads. And I think that's one of the really great things that we have about the paleo degree at Flinders too.
Yeah. Did you always have the aim of like being a scientist and working with fossils?
Yep. I'm one of those.
Excellent.
Tragics that was playing with dinosaurs at five and never grew out of it.
What is it about megafauna that has your heart now?
Well, I did my degree at Adelaide University and they actually didn't have any vertebrate paleo. It was all invertebrate paleo that I was exposed to.
Of course, because there's the Ediacaran hills and a lot of like early soft squishy life.
Yep. And Great Cambrian deposits as well down at Emu Bay on Kangaroo Island. But my parents actually just happened to meet Rod Wells on a road trip down at Narracourt. I wasn't even there, and got talking to him, and they said they had a son interested in paleontology. And he said, well, I'm going to be digging up megafauna at Rocky River on Kangaroo Island. If he wants to come and volunteer, he's welcome. So I signed up for that. 3 days into my first ever dig, I was digging up a diprotodon skull.
Wow. Okay. And diprotodon is like the biggest marsupial that's ever lived.
Yeah. So this is a skull about a meter long.
Are they that? I didn't realize they were that big.
Yep.
Okay. I've seen photos of Jacob, who featured in our VAMP episode, the Virtual Australian Museum of Paleontology, which you also were on, and Dr. Alice Clement too. Yep. I've seen photos of him scanning it on a trolley. I didn't realize it was a meter. It must be a perspective thing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this is one of the great things about what Jake's been doing with all of the scanning of the diprotodontids, is that it is quite an effort even just to turn over a diprotodon skull. So to have digital data available for a whole bunch of different ones is actually really a powerful tool.
And to segue into Thylacoleo as well, like, how old are the fossils that we're talking about?
Well, I mean, Thylacoleonids are known, the family that Thylacoleo belongs to, are known from 25 million years ago through to about 47,000 years ago. But there are lots of different genera and species encompassed within that. The earliest members in the record are cat-sized or even smaller than that. So Microleo was a really tiny animal. When we get through to the Pleistocene, so the last couple of million years, we've got Thylacoleo carnifex, the biggest member of the family, that was probably somewhere around 80 or 100 kilos.
Yeah, I'd argue that Thylacoleo carnifex is the most well-known member of that group.
Absolutely. And, you know, it is basically one of the poster childs for Australian megafauna. Really.
Yeah. Logo for the VAMP website as well. Very well deserved. We touched on in that episode, there's like a juvenile skull.
Well, there's some funky stuff. Yeah. One of the really interesting things about some of the cave deposits around Australia is that they quite often have ontogenetic series, so growth series of Thylacoleo. So from the Wellington caves, from several caves in the Narracourt area, from the Nullarbor, there are not just adult Thylacoleos, but a range of different ages. And it's even been suggested that maybe Thylacoleo were denning in caves, and that's why we see sort of more than we would expect to find in them.
Yeah, so they were maybe like living in that area, and then also really important because they're dragging their prey into those caves to like feed and look after their young too. So they're like influencing the taphonomy, like the selection of the types of fossils in that area as well. And it's really interesting to me because I normally work on stuff that's pretty old, normally N equals one. So to be like, wow, not only do you have multiple specimens, you can actually see how they grow and change through time. Yeah. Because until you do that, you're not sure whether, oh, is this a new species? Or like, what are these changes caused by? Is it male, female? Is it like just a really big one? And yeah, what's going on?
And one of the ironic things there is that even though working at the other end of the timescale from you in the late Pleistocene, we have pretty large sample sizes, many of our megafaunal species haven't actually been studied in terms of their variation within the species. And that's fundamental to understanding the taxonomy. And yet for many of our extinct megafauna, it hasn't even been thoroughly investigated yet.
Pals and Paleo will be right back. This episode is brought to you by Dinosaur Trips. Dinosaur trips are exactly what they sound like. Each itinerary gets you up close and personal with experts and gives you backstage access into the world of paleontology, visiting museums from across the world, and even getting you onto real life dinosaur digs. There's a bunch of trips running in 2024. Alberta Badlands and Beyond is back, and so's Badlands Family Adventure. Personally, I'm eyeing off the trip to Arizona and California because I'm dying to see the La Brea tar pits, but then again, I'm also tempted to travel to Patagonia. To learn more about the 2024 trips, you can check out their website, dinosaurtrips.com, and sign up to their newsletter to be the first to find out about the new trips. And you can email Zach on zach@dinosaurtrips.com, and Zach is spelled Z-A-C-H. It's been 66 million years. Why wait any longer? Join Dinosaur Trips on the adventure of a lifetime.
Is that kind of because of the nature of the caves? Because there's a lot of bones all jammed in together. Yeah. It's not like Jurassic Park, you know, where he gets the brush out and the skeleton's just laid out there. You've got a bit of work ahead of you.
Well, I mean, it actually has a lot to do with how thinly spread we are as paleontologists across the amazing fossil record that we have in this country. Mm. So there are lots and lots of different things that still need to be worked on, and we're all chipping away at them, but there are still plenty of other areas. The other thing is that in the last 20, 30 years, we've seen a huge increase in the amount of material that has been collected all around Australia. And that's not just megafauna, obviously. It's right across the board. We've got new technology. We've got more people. We're getting out into some of these remote areas that haven't necessarily been investigated. So there's lots more material available for study now too.
Yeah. Budding paleontologists who are listening, feel free to join us if you can take the heat of the kitchen, as it were. But yeah, it's wonderful that there's so many different things that you can do once you start to like get a bit of a bigger sample size. And had the privilege of seeing you present on research that you kind of teased when we did the VAMP interview as well. And it was on the interactions of Thylacoleo with other animals that were around in that time. So can you like paint a picture and sort of tell us about what other animals were around when Thylacoleo was around?
Sure. So we mentioned Diprotodon earlier, mm-hmm. our biggest marsupial that ever lived.
And please, for the sake of Jacob Van Zolen, don't call it a giant wombat because it doesn't have square poo. It's not right.
But on the subject of giant wombats, there was a real giant wombat that was around with Diprotodon, so an animal called Phascolonus gigas. Then we have a whole range of extinct kangaroos, and they can be broadly divided into two different groups. The short-faced kangaroos, which were predominantly browsers, meaning that they ate mainly leaves, and then the long-faced kangaroos, the macropodines, and that includes some extinct members, but also the kangaroos that we've got around today, like our reds and our greys and things. So the kangaroos made up a huge part of the megafaunal diversity.
Surprise, surprise, yep. This is Australia.
But we also have other carnivores. So things like the Tasmanian devil and the thylacine were all over mainland Australia until relatively recently. But we have a whole range of smaller animals as well that are spread across the mainland. So when we say megafaunal extinction, it doesn't really encompass all of the animals that were around the time. There was even a giant sleepy lizard, for example, that weighed about 3 kilograms.
Telequiferengus?
Yep, that's
yep,
the one.
Yep. So go back and listen to the episode with Kayla. It's like an armful of lizard, which is absolutely mind-boggling to think about.
But in addition to the big mammals, we also had a big bird called Geniornis, a giant flightless bird that probably weighed 150, 200 kilograms.
Hey, it's your host Adele with a quick conversion for you. So Geniornis is 150 to 200 kilos. That's equivalent to 330 to 440 pounds, a heckin' big bird. And Telequifrangens, the big sleepy lizard, that's 3 kilos. So that's 6.6 pounds. Okay, let's get back to the episode.
And then you've got things like Megalania, a giant varanid or goanna, probably about twice the body mass of a Komodo dragon.
Yeah. Queensland Museum at the Dinosaurs Unearthed exhibition, which is free. So if you're in Brisbane, check that out. They have one and it's like rearing up. It's very impressive. It's gorgeous.
And they do everything big in Queensland. The biggest of the Megalania fossils are all from Queensland as well.
So. Get amongst it. Queensland represent. So normally on the podcast, we try and talk about form, function, family. I'll try not to take too many tangents. Let's talk about form.
Yep.
And has opposable thumbs just about.
This thing is a weird animal in every respect. So yeah, unlike any of the placental mammal carnivores, like our big cats and bears and wolves, whatever it might be, Thylacoleo had opposable digits. So when placental carnivores are grabbing onto their prey, they're relying on their claws to hook on. Mm. They can't actually grasp with thumbs like we do. But Thylacoleo had a great big thumb with a really big claw on it that would have been excellent for grasping onto prey. And it's got a whole range of other adaptations to its particular lifestyle as well. And what one of the really strange things about Thylacoleo is it's actually a carnivore that has evolved from herbivorous ancestors. And so something that many people may not know is that essentially when we look at our placental carnivore guilds, they have been carnivorous for tens, if not hundreds of millions of years. So they don't switch diet. And it's actually the same for most of our carnivorous marsupials. So things like our thylacine, Tassie devil, all of our little dasyurids and things, they're all kind of part of one group. But Thylacoleo has done its own thing. And it's evolved into a niche that is essentially not seen anywhere else in the world. So in addition to those claws that are good for grasping prey, they're actually good for climbing trees as well. And we see other aspects of the skeleton of Thylacoleo that suggest it was a pretty adept climber. So
the original drop bear.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Just on the switching between like herbivore and carnivore thing too, I was thinking as you were talking, and it's like, oh, you need the hardware and the software as well. You need the like exterior and the interior to cope with changes in diets and stuff. How big is Thylacoleo, like body size?
Yeah, we're looking at something that's, you know, maybe 75 centimeters tall at the shoulder. It's often kind of compared to a leopard in that respect. So it's not, you know, an African lion kind of sized animal.
Yeah.
There's been a bit of debate over its body mass.
As there often is.
Well, you know, the fact of the matter is that there are a whole bunch of different methods that we can use for predicting body size in these extinct animals. But, you know, you have a look at a wombat today, they're so chunky and we wouldn't necessarily guess how nuggety they are just from looking at the skeleton, even though the skeleton is pretty robust. So it can be quite difficult to figure out how chunky an animal is. And one of the things about Thylacoleo is that it was probably pretty robustly built, so big muscle mass. So even though it's relatively small, it might be heavier than a placental carnivore of the same size.
Yeah, it's not lightly built. No. It's made to roll with the punches, as it were. And then to me, one of the most distinct things about this group is the lower jaw and the dentition, like the teeth, because they're not teeth like you and I have.
Yeah. And that's actually a key point of this evolving from herbivorous ancestors. So essentially, it's had to take, rather than having all of these nice pointy teeth and big canines like we see in our placentals, it's basically taken a possum-like dentition. And then over the course of 30-odd million years, evolved that to what we see in Thylacoleo carnifex, where it's pushed out nearly all of its cheek teeth. So instead of having three premolars and four molars like its ancestors did, it's got one big functional premolar, a long blade-like premolar with a couple of accessory teeth either side, basically.
Yeah, no grinding teeth. I just want to cut.
Yep. And it, you know, it acts like a pair of secateurs for cutting through flesh.
And bone.
Yeah.
Yep. Should we talk a little bit maybe about the work that you presented this week?
Yeah. So one of the things that I really like working on in parallel with assessing functional morphology in skeletons is the trace fossil record.
Mm.
So these are things like fossil footprints that record behavior of animals.
You can get walking pace and stuff out of it.
Absolutely. Yeah. And one of the things that's really special about that to me is when we're looking at a skeleton, we make predictions about most likely what it was doing. But a trace fossil is recording that behavior. So it's not ambiguous. You know, if we've got a Thylacoleo trackway with footprints in it, we know that that's how Thylacoleo was walking. And the project that I was presenting on this week is where we've actually looked at another kind of trace fossil, and that is bite marks that it's left behind on bones.
Yeah, so you weren't actually looking at bones of Thylacoleo. It was a lot of actually kangaroo bones.
Yeah, that's right. So, and in fact, it wasn't just kangaroo bones. What we looked at was a range of different collections that had already been made from Central Australia, from Coastal Australia, from New South Wales, Victoria and South Australia, from arid environments, from temperate environments. So a total of about 18,500 bones and bone fragments, specifically looking for those that had been modified by carnivores. And then within that subset, we separated those that we were pretty confident had been marked by Thylacoleo.
Yeah. And when you say marked, they kind of vary anywhere between like scratches to gouges, or even like the bones kind of got like a whoop in it, almost like
a big deep V.
Yeah, basically. Big deep V. It's like if it was made out of plasticine, you just kind of pushed into it. It's just kind of molded around this mark.
And those big, long, blade-like premolars that we were just talking about are absolutely crucial to this, because most other carnivores have similarities in their dentition, which means the bite marks that they leave behind are all relatively similar.
So you mean like between upper and lower jaw?
Yeah. But Thylacoleo, because its teeth are so different in shape, it leaves different marks on bones, which allows us to kind of separate them out.
Yeah, and say that's a Thylacoleo,
And in fact, because these premolars are blade-like, the marks that they leave behind often have more in common with a human butchery mark than they do with other carnivores.
Makes things very challenging, considering there's overlap between First Nations.
Yeah, absolutely. And it can, and you know, it can be potentially exciting or contentious sometimes, in that if it's a post-human arrival deposit that you're working on and you see these blade-like marks, you sort of start to think, well, am I looking at a genuine human butchery mark or a Thylacoleo bite mark? And that's something that you've got to assess. And I should just say as well that where we currently are at the moment in Australian megafaunal paleontology, we don't have any definite human cut marks on megafaunal bones.
Yeah, we saw that at the conference as well. It has been reported before, and then someone who was part of that original team has now put forward, they've re-looked at some of the bones from the past, and it seems that, no, these bones were actually marked a significant amount of time after they had sort of dried and the marrow was out. And, yeah, it's just really fascinating.
And in some cases, they have actually just been marked by Thylacoleo rather than by humans as
well. Yeah, so, and the climate was changing as well, as you said.
Yeah, there's a lot going on in that period, so it can be kind of tricky to disentangle what's happening.
Circling back to the research that you presented this week, did you see like any patterns in bones that had been marked by Thylacoleo?
Well, coming back to that, what we were talking about earlier about sample size, this is quite a different kind of study for me, in that we actually have a good data set to work with.
Yeah, N doesn't equal one.
Yeah. So from those 8,500 bones, we found 120 that were marked by Thylacoleo, and nearly half of them are kangaroo heel bones or calcanei.
Yeah.
And this is interesting because that is a part of the body that doesn't have meat on it.
It's not good eating.
No, it's where the Achilles tendon attaches, the gastrocnemius tendon. So what we're looking at, what we've interpreted as, is that we're looking at a hunting strategy rather than a feeding strategy.
Yeah. So, makes sense. Like if you're chasing after a roo, the legs are probably the first thing that you would contact. Like you could try and get the tail, but good luck.
But the other thing as well is that you only need one good chomp to the ankle and that kangaroo is not going anywhere.
Yeah.
So it's a really quick way of disabling the prey. But it's also high risk. We've seen all of those videos of kangaroos kicking each other or even kicking people if they're getting in the wrong place at the wrong time. So that would have been something that Thylacoleo had to deal with too.
High risk, high reward. Yep. But equivalent to throwing a stick in the front spokes of their wheel and having them just go head over tail, and hopefully, if you're quick.
And I should point out there as well that the morphology of the Thylacoleo skeleton suggests that it was probably an ambush predator, not a pursuit predator. So this is, it might be hiding in vegetation around a waterhole, waiting for the kangaroos to drink, then coming out, knock them over, chomp the ankle. It's unlikely that they're going to be chasing them down over the plain, cheetah style.
Scratch that. Yeah, the original drop bear.
So one of the other things that we see is not only kangaroo bones, the main thing that is represented, but they mainly belong to that group I mentioned earlier, the long-faced or macropodine kangaroos. And this is really weird. So we've got a huge radiation of our stenurine short-faced kangaroos, giant lumps of protein wandering around the landscape, and yet Thylacoleo doesn't seem to have been targeting them really. So then the question becomes, well, what is eating these animals? What is eating Diprotodon as well? It's not particularly well represented.
Because for a long time, I think people just assumed, Thylacoleo would be eating Diprotodon, because it's just very sexy to think of the marsupial lion, which I guess is something that we have Richard Owen to either thank or shake our fists at for, calling it Thylacoleo. Yeah, just kind of setting up this idea without really having the evidence behind it too.
I mean, it is well demonstrated now that it's absolutely an apex mammalian predator in Pleistocene ecosystems. However, we have this tendency to try and line up all of our marsupials to the trophic levels and arrangements that we see in placental-dominated ecosystems.
In North America and Africa.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And those carnivore guilds are a lot more complex than what we see in Australia. Essentially, for our carnivores in our mammals, we've got devils, thylacines, and Thylacoleo, and none of them appear to have been adapted to going after the biggest of the animals. Then we've got crocodiles, big crocodiles, but mostly limited to our waterways. Some were, as we've seen in this conference, maybe a little bit more terrestrial.
So check out the episode on Trilophosuchus with Yorgo Rostevsky for that.
Yep. And then we've got Megalania as well. But we also have to remember that reptiles don't need to eat as often as our mammals do. So they're unlikely to be effective predators in terms of regulating population sizes. So one of the things that we still need to investigate is whether there might have been other mechanisms in Australian ecosystems, like climate limitations, that might have been the main controller of large mammal populations rather than it being driven by predation.
Yeah, seasonality, boom, bust. We're in the land of drought and flooding rains. It's, yeah, it's a factor that we need to think about in the past and into the future. But yeah, in terms of how it's functioning and its ecosystem, yeah, it's a apex predator, nothing stepping to it, but it's probably not as big like a, there's been the term ecosystem engineer thrown around this week.
Well, yeah, it's still, it's going to, like, just like any other carnivore, it's going to be regulating the population sizes of its prey, but not of the things outside of that. And so, you know, what that means is that we're going to have Thylacoleo being influenced by the abundance of its particular prey as well. Now, when we talk about megafaunal extinction, we've got two main competing hypotheses about the relative roles of climate versus human.
Yeah, it would be a bit of both.
Yeah. But in the case of Thylacoleo, we've got a kind of interesting addition to the story, because Thylacoleo is known from all over Australia, even in Tasmania. So it's living in all environments, essentially. It's not an arid adapted animal. It's a kangaroo adapted animal. If there's a kangaroo in that environment, then it's going to potentially be living
for Australia.
But its prey are still alive today. So it's not that its prey disappeared necessarily that drove it extinct. However, 65,000 years ago, we saw a new apex predator arrive in Australian ecosystems, and we know that our First Nations people still eat kangaroo today.
Yeah.
So it could actually be that we're seeing what's called competitive exclusion. People were better at hunting kangaroos than Thylacoleo was, and so its food source dwindled to the point where its population was no longer viable.
To make the most crass comparison that might resonate with Australian listeners, competitive exclusion is when COVID happened and then one person just bought all the toilet rolls and then everyone else couldn't get the toilet rolls. It's like that, but for food.
Yep, absolutely.
I might cut that. We'll see.
I like that analogy.
it gets the point across in probably the worst possible way. It's such a fascinating animal, and there are no like mummified specimens or anything like that.
No, I mean, there are some absolutely spectacular skeletons that have been found from the Nullarbor and from Narracourt in particular. But yeah, no soft tissue impressions or anything like that. No,
they would have had fur being.
And in fact, the one place where it's possible to find that, we'll be out at Lake Calabona, where animals got stuck in the mud, and there is soft tissue preservation sometimes, but Thylacoleo is extremely rare in that site.
So again, leaning into the living in a cave, cave-dwelling animal as well.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's a fascinating animal, and we're just, you know, finding out more and more about it each time. But essentially, this is really the first study that has been able to look at the trace records as it relates to Thylacoleo on a larger scale. So other people have made observations about Thylacoleo bite marks on bones, but often working with relatively limited sample sizes.
Yeah, using experimental data. I think way many moons ago when I was a wee honors student, I think I remember seeing someone present about biomechanics of Thylacoleo and trying to do bite force.
Yeah, so Steve Rowe's done a fair bit of work on that side of things.
Yeah.
And in fact, what we're doing in the next stage of our project, which we haven't done yet, is to, rather than try and work out theoretical bite forces, we're going to put the Thylacoleo 3D printed teeth in a machine and produce the marks on modern kangaroo bone that we see in the fossils and then measure the force that's required to do that.
Yeah.
So we know that Thylacoleo had to have been able to generate that force because the marks are there on the bones. Mm. So it's kind of coming at it from the other
full
way around
circle,
this time.
Yeah, reverse engineering it.
Yeah, so I'm really keen to see what that, you know, may well confirm Steve's predictions about bite force. It might be completely different. We'll see, hopefully find out in the not too distant future.
Yeah, that would be amazing just to have like a lab and like have, you know, a machine with mm-hmm. a little replica fossil and just...
Well, actually, so, and feel free to cut this out if it's not appropriate, but we're filming with the ABC Catalyst crew at the moment, a documentary on megafaunal extinction that's going to air in Science Week next year, next August. And part of that is going to involve this bite force analysis. So you'll be able to watch that.
That's going to be amazing. I'm going to definitely tune into that. To circle back to trace fossils, well, I don't really work a whole lot with trace fossils. I'm more like a bone person.
Although pterosaur trace fossils are pretty damn cool.
They are cool and very weird.
Yeah.
How do you know? Are you working out that you've got a Thylacoleo track, like set of footprints and stuff mm-hmm. based on the thumb?
Well, that's actually a really interesting point because from what we've found, and we've got quite a variety of different ways in which Thylacoleo footprints preserve, mm-hmm. but from what we've found, it does look like the thumb was probably being held off the ground while it was walking. But we've got a range of different foot pad impressions. Sometimes it's just the pad without any kind of digit impression.
Yep. So like, I guess the heel of the palm or something.
Kind of, but then other trackways, we've just got claws and not much else. So it partly depends on how soft the sediment was when the tracks were being imprinted, but also how fast the animal was moving, what the substrate was made of, all those kinds of things.
You get these things like overprints and underprints, I mm-hmm. think, too, as
just
well.
Just to make it even more complex.
Yeah, sometimes that layer, a bit of it's eroded away and you just maybe have the deepest part that went into the ground, not like the full entry point in that too. Again, this is why I kind of have avoided track fossils a little bit.
Well, yeah, and actually the only Thylacoleo traces that we've published so far, we've got some in the works at the moment. The ones we've published were from the Victorian volcanic plains, so actually not that far from where we are today. And what we see in those is predominantly four digit impressions from the hands. So the digits are longer than we would see in something like a, you know, a thylacine, for example. They've got more dog-like, the little beans, rather than long fingers.
Yep. Excellent. And Thylacoleo, I'm guessing like five digits?
Well, four. So four. Okay. It's because that thumb is held up off.
Yeah, but on the hand, it's got five.
Yes,
so it's making four on the ground and then back foot, same number of digits?
Well, we don't have digit impressions for the back foot.
What?
So
it's just doing arm day? It's missing leg day?
Yeah, pretty much.
Oh, my God. Okay. Again, well, yeah, I guess like is that typical of ambush predator?
No, I think it has more to do with the specific taphonomy of the site that we're
the way the sediments are. Okay. You mentioned pterosaurs before. A lot of pterosaur tracks, just to take a tangent, even though I said I wouldn't, they can be quite a lot just like manis only. Mm-hmm. So again, pterosaurs are all arm day, very little leg day going on. So it's, really rare to see both.
Their hands are turned around backwards, aren't they? The digits
there are. The wing has to be held off the ground and then a few little nubs are making contact with the ground. But
I was actually lucky enough to see some really cool pterosaur trackways in Morocco. At a ichnology conference when I was over there. But pretty amazing.
As you mentioned before, you can learn a lot from an animal, from like how it moves and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And the more lines of evidence that you can sort of pull together, the better we can understand these animals that really don't look anything like we have around. Talking about family grouping and like the taxonomy, mm-hmm. is it pretty well sorted
there's a can of worms.
This happens every time. Taxonomy is fake. So everyone's just like, ugh.
The competing hypotheses have been that thylacoleonids are either sort of in some way related to possums or they're in the group that includes wombats and koalas.
quite two different groups.
Well, yes and no. If you go far enough back, they're kind of same ancestor kind of thing. But what we're probably looking at is that within vombatiforms, so that includes Diprotodon and Palacestes, as well as our wombats and koalas and those kind of things, they're more closely related to koalas, but it's not clear whether they're on a lineage that includes koalas as well, or if they're actually kind of basal to the whole radiation.
Yeah. Opposable thumbs have evolved multiple times in multiple groups, so that's not super useful.
So we all know koalas have two thumbs.
Yes. Some people might not know. Sorry, if you're in North America, koalas have two thumbs.
Yep.
And it's not like on opposite sides of the hands. I think they're both together on the same one. Yeah, I remember it because a mate of mine has like a really distinct tattoo of a koala handprint. Shout out Caesar. Awesome.
But we actually see the same thing in ringtail possums and some cuscuses as well have two thumbs. Okay. So it's probably not a phylogenetic signal of relatedness. It's probably evolved multiple times.
Living in a tree, having one thumb's great. Having two thumbs, though, even better.
Well, on that subject, and I'm not going to reveal it here because it's a big secret, but in the Pleistocene on exactly that subject, we've got a pretty fantastic discovery that is being written up at the moment. So.
Oh, my gosh.
But you have to stay tuned.
So many exciting things. Other than, I guess, the fact that Phylacoleo is ankle biter of
it's not quite as glamorous as the, you know, Thylacoleo leaping down on the back of Diprotodon from the tree, but sometimes you got to go where the data takes you.
Yeah, sometimes we do let science get in the way of a good story. This might be like really hard to answer, but is there any idea of whether they might have hung out together and hunted together?
That's a really good question and really hard to assess.
Yeah.
So essentially the only information that we've got that contributes to that is these potential dens in caves that suggest Thylacoleo might be living in family groups and things like that. But in terms of hunting, who knows? Unless we find trackways of groups moving together, or we find a carcass that's got different sizes, then that would be amazing to see. But, you know, maybe a big carcass where mum's taken it down and you see the little Thylacoleo young bite marks as well where they're feeding on it. But, yeah, I think it's a pretty long shot.
Yeah, I mean, it could be out there. I don't know. It's just interesting thinking of placentals and stuff. I think in domesticated cats, I've heard that mama cat will, like, take live prey back to the kittens for them to finish off, to teach them how to hunt.
And that may well be the case with Thylacoleo. There's actually a couple of different theories there. So one of them is that in filling that leopard-like role, it might have actually hauled its kills up into a tree, and that helps keep it away from other predators and scavengers.
But, except for birds.
Especially giant eagles.
Yeah.
But the other thing might be that it's dragging it back into a cave as well.
Yeah.
And
it's harder for birds to get into caves, as we've seen this week, but it also means sometimes if they get in there, they don't get out, which is great for fossils.
Absolutely.
We've got a little bit of time left. Can I just circle back to your story like a little bit more and stuff?
Yeah.
So, yeah, you've been based in South Australia for
basically your whole career. Yeah,
that's kind of rare.
Yeah, I was actually extremely lucky. And when I came out of my PhD, I was kind of working as a lab tech. I was doing fossil prep and working in paleo, but not as a researcher.
Yeah.
And then I was just in the right place at the right time. Gavin Prideaux had just been expanding paleontology at Flinders University. He got his future fellowship and his teaching was kind of backfilled as a result of that. So in 2014, I started as a lecturer in paleontology at Flinders and I've been in that role ever since. So, and then in 2019, we introduced Australia's first and only full paleontology degree.
Yeah.
And we basically designed a degree that was everything we wished we could have studied when we went through undergrad.
Yeah. So, a friend of mine said, they basically made what I did, but they've actually put like the correct label on it. But yeah, it's amazing to see that it exists because, yeah, I talk to people and like they're keen for it. There's a big appetite for it to learn more about Australia's ancient past. With your PhD, was it on megafauna at all? Or?
Yeah, so I worked on Diprotodontids, the biggest of the megafauna, and kind of feeding into this whole trace fossil thing, I'm much less interested in the head end than the rest. So I'm a postcranial morphology boy.
Yep.
And so I was actually looking at the postcranial morphology of diprotodontids and what we could learn in both a functional and a phylogenetic context.
Yeah, so veto the head and then everything else, that's where it's at.
And it's actually really, really challenging to get a meaningful phylogenetic signal out of postcranial morphology, especially when you're looking at a relatively diverse group where you've got climbers and you've got potential, you know, scratch diggers and then big gravipotal animals that are adapted to weight bearing. And so what we saw in the phylogenetic implications were that climbers group together, diggers group together. But essentially what we see in that kind of functional transition is that our earlier diprotodontids from, you know, 15, 20, 25 million years ago are often adapted to climbing. Yep. They're moving around in forested environments. Mm-hmm. And then as Australia is opening up in the later Miocene, they're getting bigger in body size, spending more time on the ground. And then coming into the Pliocene and Pleistocene, they're getting really big and they're just showing adaptations towards extreme weight bearing. And in fact, that is what Jacob van Zolen is now carrying on with, his trying to get his head around what some of those adaptations are, but also looking at the head end and trying to sort out the taxonomy, which I do not envy him at all.
I'll ask you two last questions before we wrap up. One is not going to be too unexpected because I did say it was your homework in the VAMP episode. But yeah, considering Australia is a lot more arid now, how likely is it that something like Thylacolea could evolve again in Australia the way we're headed?
Well, it's going to need a long time.
Yeah.
So, I mean, what we're more likely to see is that we're going to see all of those invasive placental mammals evolving to fill many niches in Australia.
Terrifying.
So, well, I mean, introduction of the dingo 5,000-ish years ago has meant that we've actually had a replacement of our macropodid specialist, and you know, it probably led to the extinction of devils and thylacines on mainland Australia.
Because of competitive exclusion.
Again, grabbing all the toilet rolls again.
So we've
seen that sort of multiple times, and it's going to be really difficult to turn around that invasive species movement through Australia because
it's getting bigger than
environment. And maybe we'll have genetic warfare, if you like, advances that allow us to address that in a meaningful way. But at the moment, they're through all of our ecosystems. So if we went extinct tomorrow, we'd just see placental mammals filling a lot of those niches. And unfortunately, because they often breed faster and have often evolved in an ecosystem where there might have been sort of higher selection pressures for evolving various different kinds of either prey capture or predator avoidance strategies. So they're kind of in some ways
one step
better prepared for having to deal with placental carnivores. Yeah. So I think our fauna, unfortunately, are on the back foot a bit. So I think the short answer to your question is it's unlikely that we'd see another Thylacolea evolve. The flip side is that I know there are people who are working on extraction of Thylacolea DNA
really?
At the moment.
Oh, yep. Boy.
So that would be the way that we'd bring it back if it were going to be brought back.
It would be interesting to find a surrogate for that. Anyway, I guess you have to work out Team Possum or Team Wombat Koala.
Well, I really want to see that research come out because it'll help us answer that question about where Thylacolea fits in that evolution of diprotodontian marsupials.
Last question. Pop culture references. Thylacolea is, again, a very well-known fossil. It was described in, is it 1806?
1859.
Was that, okay. So. Yeah. I was off by a bit, but yeah, by like an English dude, because that's what happened in Australia in the early days.
Colonialism.
Yay. Yeah. But yeah, it's pretty iconic, and you might be able to speak to this a bit better. Like, if you're visiting any of the museums around Australia, where can you see a Thylacolea?
So a few of the museums have Thylacoleas on display, but one of the best places you can see them is Narracourt Caves.
Yes.
And in fact, our lab technician, Kerry Burke, is currently in the process of building a new dynamic mount of Thylacoleo leaping onto prey.
Oh, wow.
And that's largely been made possible by the digital revolution we're undertaking at the moment, the ability to scan fossils and
create these really high-quality replicas.
Mm-hmm. And replicate things that are so delicate that you probably don't want to just cast them straight off the fossil as well.
Yeah. Pop culture references. Mm-hmm. There's a movie that you told me about.
Oh, yes. So a local one for me.
Yes.
Shot in the Adelaide Hills called Carnifex.
That's right.
Yeah, so this... like really interesting idea after all the bushfires, all of the animals that were out in the middle of nowhere have been driven in close to suburbia, and Thylacoleo has survived and changed and moved into this new area, and people have to deal with being stalked by this displaced predator.
Lock your doors.
Take a step back from reality, but I enjoyed the ride.
Yeah. I still have to see it. Do you know where people can see it?
No, I don't.
Yeah, just look it up online. You know, you all know how to use Google. You're all smart, clever.
Yep.
Clever things. And one last plug for VAMP. If you can't get to a museum, if you're based in like the middle of nowhere, like I am, you can hop on the VAMP website and see. Yep. There's at least one.
So, there's basically a complete skeleton, and that is the skeleton that we used the skull from in this bite force analysis project.
Yep.
Although we've had to make a few modifications because it was missing a couple of bits of its skull.
Yeah.
But some of the Thylacoleo bite marked material is actually already up on VAMP as well, and more of that will be added as the website expands too. So,
any Thylacoleo coprolites, any fossil poo?
Not yet.
Not yet, that's right.
But we've got a very nice one from the Victorian volcanic plains with a great big chunk of bone in it.
That would hurt passing that.
Absolutely. And it's a sharp bit of bone too. Oh. So it's probably about 8 to 10 centimetres long.
Oh my God. No one can see except for Aaron, but I'm crossing my legs because not much chewing going on.
No. This is actually an interesting and extra dimension to it as well. There's been argument over whether it was a flesh specialist or what ability it had to crunch bones, because usually in, things like a hyena, for example, that's adapted to crunching bones, we see particular adaptations in its teeth to stop bone shards digging down into the gums when the bone breaks. But we don't see that in the premolar of Thylacoleo. And yet we've got fairly large pieces of kangaroo foot bones, for example, that have gone the whole way through the digestive system of Thylacoleo. So they've got Thylacoleo bite marks and digestive damage on them. So it was able to eat these big chunks of bone.
So the bones seem like pretty well digested compared to, I don't know,
generally speaking, no.
Yeah,
but okay. We've only got a few that show digestive damage. And then the other aspect, I guess, is that Tasmanian devils also consume bone.
Yes.
So unless you've got a bite mark on it, or unless it's a particularly large piece of bone, you can't necessarily say that was definitely Thylacoleo. So we've got a couple of key specimens that do demonstrate that Thylacoleo is doing it, but in terms of the larger pattern there, it's a bit tricky to figure out.
I think that's an awesome place to leave it. Thank you so much for telling us about Thylacoleo Carnifex.
Thanks for having me.
No worries. And everyone keep eyes peeled on more research on this incredible stuff and from Flinders. Where can people find you on social media if they want to keep up, or they could also just, sign up and do paleo at Flinders at undergrad?
Harder to find these days because I am no longer supporting the artist formerly known as Twitter. So it's making things a little bit more difficult to find. But you can find us through the Flinders website. And that's a good way to both access the undergrad opportunities that we have, as well as the
projects research for honours and PhDs if people want to.
And we've got a whole range of different people at Flinders, different projects on offer, and we're always happy to have a chat about honours and PhD potential opportunities.
And you don't just have to take a project that's on offer. Like if you have an idea that you're super passionate about, I'd highly recommend, trying to shop it around and bring it to someone too. It is extra work to do it that way, but depending on what you're interested in, like it's definitely something that you can do.
Yeah, and we've got lots and lots of cool fossils that haven't been worked on yet that still need to be worked on, so plenty of different opportunities.
Yeah, awesome. And if I don't see you in person, I'll see you at the next CavApps 2025 South Australia. Let's go!
Absolutely,
Oh my gosh. Aaron, thank you so much for coming back on the show to tell us about Thylacoleo, being so accommodating and flexible, especially at the end of a conference, no less, and a big week of Aussie Paleo. Before we wrap up with final thank yous, I wanted to let you know that yes, there is a Thylacoleo Yowie, which if you're new here, that's a little plastic toy that was made in the early 2000s. But the only way you could get your hands on them is if you bought their chocolate. So it was like an Easter egg situation. You eat the chocolate and then there's little parts you put together to make your toy. And the Thylacoleo Yowie has its really distinct blade-like teeth we've been talking about this whole episode, and the thumb too. In fact, it's like Thylacoleo is giving you a thumbs up and smiling. It's very encouraging, very sweet. And the other thing I wanted to talk about is where you can see Thylacoleo fossils on display. So in a moment of serendipity, after I finished recording with Aaron, I decided to kill some time and visit the Melbourne Museum, check out the Gondwana Garden, and see the replica jaws of Coolosuchus. Again, thanks to Jessica Campbell and Jack O'Connor for telling me they exist and where to find them. Little did I know, not only were there life-size jaws of Coolosuchus in the Gondwana Garden, but a giant, bright yellow Thylacoleo skull. I'll post photos of it to the Pals in Paleo Instagram, but they have this fake cave wall with a one-to-one replica of Thylacoleo, like, embedded in the wall, and that's right next to this huge replica skull that's easily three times bigger than I am. Melbourne Museum also have a Thylacoleo on display inside the museum proper, although I struggled to find it on my last visit, but there's a skull on display at the Queensland Museum in Brisbane as part of the Dinosaurs Unearthed exhibit, which is free. There's a replica of the skeleton in like a fake ground situation at the National Dinosaur Museum in Canberra, plus a display at Bulabartip at Western Australian Museum. And of course, best for last, there's a dynamic skeletal mound at Nerricourt Caves National Park, which Aaron mentioned in our episode. As always, if you know of other museum displays and want to share that with the Pals and Paleo community, just message me at Pals and Paleo and I'll give us an update in a future episode. Thanks for being part of the PIP community. If you want to give back to the show, leave a rating or review on Apple Podcasts and I'll love you basically forever. Yes, it gives me a warm, fuzzy feeling when you do that, but it helps the show spread and connect the podcast with more Paleo people. This show wouldn't be possible without support from Francie, who edits the show so beautifully. Francie also brought our theme song to life with his band Hello Kelly. They are on hiatus at the moment, but you can still find their music, including their album Sweet Nostalgia, on a bunch of platforms, and Francie's solo stuff on Spotify. Just search Francie Planet. Our podcast cover art is by Jenny Zhao, freelance creative and co-founder of Crumpet Clubhouse. You can find them on Instagram at Jenny Z Design and at Crumpet Clubhouse, all one word. Pals in Paleo will be back soon with fresh facts on old fossils. But until next time, look after yourself, drive safe, and just keep digging.